In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. O Heavenly King. O Christ, our God, we ask that you illumine our minds and hearts as we approach these difficult but important topics, that you guide our discussion and guide our minds to understand what you have created us to be. For you are a good God, and you love mankind and have a purpose for us. Amen. To wait a few more hours for that first prayer. So we'll begin our talk today titled, Are Humans Fluid or Solid? And the second part of that question is, what is human nature? So we'll be talking about applying greatly a lot of the first lectures to what is emerging as sort of a very, not sort of, it is gaining traction as a teaching, a movement, an ideology called transhumanism, and various as sort of the forefront that has the clearest vision, or at least is the most explicit in what it is that they desire for humanity. We'll approach transgender issues within that lens as sort of a subcategory of the broader transhumanist goals, or perhaps just a particular application of transhumanist philosophies to gender and the human body in regard to gender. So all of this deals with what is human nature? Is it changeable? And to what purpose can we change? Can human nature be changed to if it is changeable? So these are the questions that will be before us. I think that almost all people can be, in the modern world, can be divided in sort of two ways on when it comes to this idea of what human nature is. There are those who act and believe that human beings and therefore human nature can be known, conquered, and then molded, just as the physical world can be known, conquered, and then molded. And those who act and believe that human nature is static and objective and must be accounted for accordingly in human behavior and in human action. I think largely we have these two camps that are basically not talking to each other. Or if they are, they're largely arguing with one another, and at heart, they don't have a ground for which to meet and understand one another. And so some of this will be an attempt to see what those things are, why we can't get to sort of an agreement on what this means. Perhaps my own ideas will emerge from this lecture why I think that's the case, and how compatible is the first with Christianity in general. I think the driver of that first mentality, that human nature and human beings can be known, conquered, and then molded to whatever shape, based off that knowledge and off that sort of, when I say conquering, I mean the ability to shape and mold it. You know, and so you think because of that knowledge of something about human nature, some aspect of human nature, that now you've conquered it, and it's this extension of what of a view of the physical world to the human body as well, sort of the human body as mere biomass that we are. The driver of that latter mentality, I believe to be rooted or driven by an ever-increasing removal from nature itself, or creation, you could say, from the created things of God and of the earth, via technological solutions. So the more technological solutions that sort of mediate our experience of nature, of the created world, the further and easier it seems to be for human beings to think of themselves as sort of just this thing that can be known, conquered, and then molded into whatever shape, just like we do to the earth. We won't approach questions of whether we should view, I don't think we should be viewing the physical world in that way either, but this is an extension of that same mentality. Ultimately, this sort of technological solutions that separate us from nature will be a complete disassociation from any knowledge of nature and the belief that human nature is simply something that's entirely fungible. We can mold it to whatever we want. The result is that all things about humans are social constructions. Everything about, even biology, is a human construction, and that can be remade. There is no reference in transhumanism to tradition or historical refinement of any sort of social tradition as a good thing, and that that is actually held by those who think that human nature is static or objective. A caveat that we should keep in mind is that those who are opponents of this sort of fluid and moldable a view of human nature, they don't actually teach that that human nature is static in the sense that I think they're understood as. It does not mean that there is not a spectrum of expression within humanity. That's clearly evident in the vast majority of cultures that we have and of the ways that we live among one another. However, it does, what they are claiming is that humanity as a whole has both what you can think of as a horizontal relation to one another, and this relation to one another is common. When we look at the broad scope of human beings, there's not as severe differences among each other as seems to be when we are sort of just getting to know one another. But when we get to know one another, we find sort of and discover a common human nature. So there's this horizontal element of which we can discover a common human nature via getting to actually know one another from across cultures and times and regions. But even more fundamentally, and this is the part that's missing from sort of transhumanist thought in a certain respect, is what is the vertical element, the transcendental reference point of human beings as the image of God, the imago Dei, to use the Latin, that we are the image of God. So there's both this horizontal reference point, but then there's also a reference point in every human being of being in the image of God. And that stabilizes human nature. You could say it does make it solid when we have these two things. So there's a breadth of expression, but there's not as radical as we dive into what transhumanists are going, as I'm setting up the two sort of things, but as we dive into transhumanism in this next little bit, you'll see that the goals, is the most fundamental thing in their goals is this complete lack of any sort of sense of a divine origin or a divine goal. And they greatly question and deconstruct any sort of commonality among human beings. So this second camp thinks that we can know human nature by studying both and fully knowing it in the horizontal plane and getting to know it ever greater in the vertical plane, meaning getting to know God better through the divine image that we are. It's a vertical relationship that stabilizes us. So you can think of this in the Gospels as loving God and loving neighbor. It's a relational thing that stabilizes us. The questions I think that are most pertinent when we approach this topic and we should ask when we come against sort of ideas of the reshaping of human nature are several, but they're interrelated. We should ask, if humanity is changeable, by whom is it changeable? Who is changing it? I.e., who will be the creator or the decider of this new humanity? And to what purpose will it be remolded to be for? And any changes that occur, who will it benefit? And is our potentiality to grow and change, why is that taking place? You could sum all that up of why is it taking place? The big question of why. Why change and why do this at all? What I'll argue in bringing out various things is that about transhumanism is that it's a warping of the command given in the garden, right? To till and to work, turned into a man-centric sort of self-referencing point. And it's the entire theocentric reference point of God is just not there. So God the creator is simply cut out, or you can think of him as dethroned, and in place, and this is the part that I will argue is the point where they're attempting and not realizing to put a vertical reference point in, as what replaces God is some sort of future humanity. A future better, stronger, more technologically advanced and integrated version of humanity is placed instead of God and becomes the goal. So that is what transhumanism is and what its goals are. You can think of this, you can begin to see that there's a problem there, a very big problem. In a book called Game of Gods that looks at this from an author named Carl Tekrib, he says that humanity has three great desires: to be as God, to be masters of meaning and destiny, and to build heaven on earth. This is that story. And he's describing what his book will approach, right? You should start to hear echoes of the Genesis account, but stated in a different way that does not have a reference to God as a goal, to union with God. It's just not there. Rather, man is God. That's exactly what Adam and Eve did. To be masters of their own meaning and destiny. And then not a heaven in the kingdom to come that is Christ's kingdom, but some sort of paradise on earth. And these are the goals of transhumanism. He later states that the main problem here is how that is built. He says that the history of man playing God is one of deepest subjugation and destruction, like meaning that's the results of us playing God. We proclaim the good, but are unable to break from that which is evil. We are incapable of resisting the allure to become a God made in our fallen image. So everything that transhumanism builds and we'll see is based off looking simply at fallen humanity and not at redeemed humanity. And this chiefly, as we'll see, is this union of man with machine elements or technology. Man and machine working together and developing together to get to this sort of future humanity that will somehow be better or somehow utopian sometimes. Not always is it a utopian vision, but nonetheless it is a goal of the transhumanists. So, man and machine, transhumanism and technology. Elon Musk has this great quote that kind of begins to put you into the mental space of the transhumanists. And he says this: engineering is the closest thing to magic that exists in the world. So they begin to have this sort of enchantment view of technology itself. It's magical. It can do things that we haven't thought of before. This is the whole point of Elon Musk's many ventures. From Tesla to getting to Mars to drilling holes in the ground to Neuralink, which is putting a chip in your brain. These are all transhumanist goals that Elon Musk is attempting to bring to fruition. Another thing that we can see and begin to see an echo of Genesis in transhumanist thought is pointed out by Jacob Schatzer in a book he calls Transhumanism and the Image of God. There are three main waves of transhumanism, and you can what we'll begin to dive into is seeing those take place in history, recent history. So those three main waves of transhumanism are: one, a morphological freedom to change ourselves. We'll talk about what that means. Use of augmented reality to merge the physical and the digital world. And three, the pursuit of artificial intelligence to finally transcend our human limitations entirely. So we have three stages of getting to that future human person. That first stage, I think you can think of as kind of where we're broadly at as a culture now: enhancement via technology, and that it's our right to those things. It's our right to have smartphones. It's a right to have various things that enhance the capabilities of our human body. We can extend ourselves through communication means. Other people can extend their thought into our lives and into our very homes through, you know, devices of all sorts, but sort of an enhancement of our abilities if we were not to have sort of these big, highly advanced technological things. And then there's the second stage that's beginning to emerge and kind of coming to a maturity is augmented reality. I mean, I have a smartphone in my bag here. I could pull it out, and augmented reality can be as mundane as, oh, it'll put the picture of the stars in the sky when I point it at certain stars. It'll make the picture for me so I can see the constellation. Or it can be, you know, a video game. There's sort of this augmented reality in this, but there are further stages along and plans from people to begin to sort of unite to this augmented reality, where the lines of non-digital world, the non-virtual world, and the virtual world are kind of seamlessly put together, and it will be hard to pull them apart. Technologies that will allow the hardness of that to, the difficulty to pull them apart to emerge. And then the last one is a full union of, and often, as we see, will be this idea of gaining immortality through somehow uploading your mind into a machine. And this is primarily done through getting AI to be smart enough to sort of download our brain. These are stated goals of transhumanism. And your ortho ears should be sort of ringing. These are three stages that seem to parallel theological things. Purification, right? Illumination, deification. They're paralleling, but with a far different end goal, a human future end goal that's different from what God has given us to become like him. So how do we know that? Do they say these things? There's a document out there called the Transhumanist Manifesto, or also called the Designer Evolution. And in that, there are these two quotes. It says, "Man is not born free, but everywhere in biological chains. People of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your biological chains." And then a second quote. "As humanism freed us from the chains of superstition, let transhumanism free us from our biological chains." So the entire goal is to become unbound by our bodies and to somehow enhance them or integrate them into something else so that our human biological, how we're born, is just irrelevant via technology. So where are we at in these sort of stages of technology, and what sort of things do we see? First, we have sort of external tech that we've talked about, smartphone devices that are constantly with us, and in some sense we become dependent on them. I know I'm dependent on simply something as easy as maps. I probably couldn't get around to a vast majority of places without maps now, and I'm never lost because I can pull up my phone and GPS will locate me here and I'll be able to find my way home. But we've lost parts of who we are via these sort of augmented and enhancing things. Something that humans used to be able to do without technology, be able to find their way around and really have an intimate knowledge of the world around them, is lost by that sort of technology. The growth of virtual and augmented reality, as it gets better and better and more seamless, the augmented reality world starts the next stage of sort of this tech integration and begins the lure of the virtual world as being greater, usually through some sort of greater pleasure that you gain from a virtual world than you do from the real world, the physical, biological world that they want to be unbound from. How does this happen? How do we get to that next stage? The growth of implantations, sort of, you can think of chips like Neuralink that are out there. The growing popularity, and you know, it's still very underground, but there's these ideas of, well, if you just put a chip inside your hand, then it knows who you are, and then smart buildings, smart homes, smart cars, everything begins, it knows who you are, and so it, then it customizes itself to you, and it gives you access to all these sorts of things. the ideas like that are growing ever more, and we can see sort of little kernels of it. Some of them may die off, others may grow, but these ideas are gaining popularity because of the seamlessness of which it seems to augment our lives and make things easier. I no longer have to have keys in my pockets or carry anything. The RFID chip will do it all for me, or whatever other chip emerges as the popular one. Or the growing idea of biodata tracking and location tracking. We already do that with our smartphones, but they're working on technologies to be able to do this so that, you know, we can become better and healthier through data tracking. And of course, this happens through various means. It's not all free, but these are the goals of part of the transhumanist agenda, because it's very profitable to have all this data, and it's easy to sell because it makes our life seamless. One of the most a lot of people are still disturbed by it, but Elon Musk's Neuralink. The stated goal from Elon Musk is that the end goal of having a Neuralink being successful is to have a direct brain to technology control. End of the reverse, having AI be able to help your brain work better. So it does this by sort of hacking or learning brain pathways and ways of communicating within the brain. And so all of these sorts of things are technologies that hint at this. And then related to this is sort of the growing comfortability with cyborgs, growing merging of that. Being formed, they say these things, is being formed by human and machine brain and nervous system coupling. Or a human whose nervous system is linked to a computer. This is the goal. And sort of like on the checklist of transhumanist things, once we're able to seamlessly do many of these things, then we're kind of getting closer to that future man. There's a cyborg fair in Dusseldorf that has sort of all of these people coming together, putting these implantation chips in. They call themselves and have a goal of being a cyborg, and they call themselves biohackers. The important distinction here is that none of this is like therapeutic. None of it is like, I've broken something and I've broken a hip and I need a hip replacement. None of this is on that level. It's all about enhancement. There's no reference to what it is to be a healthy human being. It's a future goal with no stability, no baseline that grows from. Rather, it's a goal that I want to reach, and I'll do whatever via technology into my body to get to that goal. This is the whole goal of sort of the cyborg element of transhumanists. Kevin Warwick, who's sort of one of the pioneers within this movement, says that talks of a future in which cyborgs will view ordinary human beings as lower beings, just as many now look on chimpanzees or cows. The thinking is that since these technologies are within your body, that it's you. It's you doing this. It's this psychological shift that they're trying to, that happens when to these people. They begin to think of these technologies as themselves. And the psychological effect is far more profound than something that you carry around and can just sort of put down on the table and walk away. You could relearn how to do other things, but it requires far more to remove yourself from these sorts of implanted technologies. So the desire for and the searching for a full merger of AI and of mind uploading is sort of like the ultimate goal. This is the ultimate union with technology and with a machine. One more quote to kind of bring out what their entire thought is, to really bring out that the whole goal of AI and the getting to know the human brain as a computer, as a massive computer, is brought out by another one of their philosophers and thinkers. His name is Alex Vikulov. By definition, post-humanism, which is, he wants to get beyond even transhumanism, he wants to get post-human, which he calls cyber-humanism, is to replace transhumanism at the center stage, circa 2035. By then, mind uploading could become a reality with gradual neural replacement, rapid advancements in strong AI, meaning AI that can actually think for itself, massively parallel computing, nanotechnology allowing us to directly connect our brains to cloud-based infrastructure of the global brain. And that's a goal of his, to get to a global brain. Via intersection with our AI assistants, the global brain will know us better than we know ourselves in all respects. So mind transfer, or rather mind migration, for billions of enhanced humans would be seamless sometime by the mid-century. The major goal is this sort of extension of human life indefinitely and of our brains, this identification that we are our brains that they make, and the brain's processing power or abilities via sort of a technological fix, because they see our inability to do it as a problem. Alex Harrington, in a book called The Immortalist, says that the philosophy that accepts death must itself be considered dead. Its questions meaningless, its consolations worn out. So you see that at the heart of transhumanist thought, in the ultimate of their goal, it's this problem that we die. And they're trying to fix it via technology. That's the ultimate goal. Of course, they all hope that it happens quicker. Maybe they realize that it's not going to happen in their lifetime. But they see this sort of work that they're doing as that someday humans will become technologically immortal. Certain humans will, at least. So, but what's that danger on the human level? Is that really even a fix? And I think there's a dead end here that is actually brought out in an article that I ran across in the Washington Post. And it says, it brings out the fact that technology isn't seamless. It's not as they're kind of picturing it. It always has problems, it grows, and then these technologies die out, right? Digital technology is ephemeral and lacks the distinctive visceral connection with history that may be much diminished, if not lost, when our cultural heritage is stored in sterile databases rather than actual objects. What's different now is that our cultural memory is embedded in a complex and ever-shifting system of technologies. Any change in the system can render the record unreadable. A book can sit on a shelf for hundreds of years and retain its legibility. All that's required to decode it is a pair of eyes. A digital file is far more fussy, dependent on computers for decoding. It can disappear or turn into gibberish whenever operating systems, software applications, or document standards are revised. We can think of ones just in our lifetime. Floppy disks exist only as an icon on our computers now. We get 404 errors by trying to upload old websites, VHS tapes, or music tapes, audio tapes from of old. Like, you can't play them anymore. The technology has disappeared, so essentially it's become nothing, right? But this idea of the ephemeral has always existed with us, but their end goal could of relying completely on the continuation of humanity within technology it's never going to be successful. Technologies come and go and change, and even if somehow theoretically it was possible, there's this dead end, right? And then there's the further danger that humanity can become bifurcated between those who are enhanced, who have embraced sort of this union with technology in these sort of extreme levels, or what we think of as extreme now, and those that are unable or unwilling to enhance their very bodies. Through this process, humanity could lose what we are and any ability to see what God created us to be as we increasingly get further and further removed from those reference points that we talked about in the beginning, from the actual objects in creation, which we observe directly with our bodily senses. The more everything is digitized and goes into the cloud, the greater the struggle to understand God's command given in the garden, either in its pre-fall form or in its post-fall form. So this is sort of the goal of transhumanism, usually via sort of the things that we know of as technology, like computers, you know, steel, chips, these sorts of things. But there's another element here too. It's not simply in that, it's in the goal of the mixing of man with other forms of, with other genes, so man and genetics. We won't go into it too much. I'll just bring up a couple points that this is here and then see how it's relevant toward our transgender topic. some years ago, I can't remember the exact year, we sort of unlocked the human genome, right? We were able to see it all now. We don't exactly know where everything is, but that's just kind of, eventually we'll kind of know what all the genes do. This is just an further extension of that humanity as like a biomass that can be manipulated. But now it's just via other biological things. But they think of these biological atoms, molecules, so on and so forth, as things that you can kind of just intermix and somehow we can hack them. There's a growing trend of making chimeras. Just a few months ago, they announced that they had successfully made a human-monkey hybrid embryo. It only lived for 19 days before it expired. But this is a technology that has been going on for a while, and the end goal is kind of to see how we can mix genes to somehow improve and get to sort of a next stage of humanity, to fix everything via that. And some people are even going as far. There's a university in the University of Western Australia that has a whole department of doing weird biological art. They take various things and kind of either take biological material and shape it, or they are doing sort of molecule level art by mixing things together on the molecular level. And so this sort of, it's called Symbiotica, and it's the biological arts department of the University of Western Australia. So these things are gaining traction in the academy and through other things, and we know that anything that begins in the academy eventually filters out to everywhere else. So transhumanism is this larger philosophy that I think transgenderism is a smaller part of this. And it's the one that confronts us more because we're just sort of able to do it now on the sort of performative level. So transgenderism, what exactly is its goal, or what is it? I think that it's just one prong of sort of this trans or post-humanist thought. It's an overturning of the gender social norms that are rooted in the Genesis account of creation, of those roles that are inherited of being born into this type of human body, which is why I think it's sort of just a subset. It's another way of saying, this human body that I have is not what I want, and so I'm going to shape it to some other thing. The other prong of the Genesis account is that we also see this in sort of the natural law approach. You can just, as we said, there's this horizontal plane, that's the natural law. We can see how the rest of humanity has kind of dealt with itself and do comparison and kind of see the similarities and commonalities and see where natural law teaches us that human bodies have a purpose, and even on the biological level, there's a purpose that we can read there. And both of those are just ignored by the transgender isms, if you will. And it's a rejection of our ecclesial teaching that we have one nature, that it's expressed in two bodily forms, and it replaces it with an ideology that human biology is only what we make it out to be. So it completely ignores any sort of biological reproduction, and at best, it will turn, and at its truest forms, it turns sort of to a different form of technological fixes for a body disjunction between their psychology and what their body is that they claim to have. Increasingly, body identities are multiplying. So it's not simply about male and female anymore. It's also about, this is why their gender identities are so long. I can't even remember the number that they claim to have that is out there right now. But part of that is that technology through either clothing or surgery or simply sort of enforcement culturally, that it makes it so that this is as if they can live in this other identity. So men and women, male and female bodies is sort of beside the point for them. They're making they're applying technology to their own bodies and then presenting it back to the world and saying, this is what I am because I've made it so. And I claim it to be so. So queer identities are at heart the full embrace of the earthly symbols of gender roles, and then a sort of a flaunting of them, or a performing of them, you could say, by sort of a mismatching of bodies to a gender expression. Transgender individuals, as we said before, go so far as to surgically alter their bodies, to add or take away sort of certain things that we think of as the biological expressions of maleness or femaleness, and then they perform. This is the language that they use. They perform the opposite gender of their birth. Then that is from what they were born as. And so this is a sort of a subset. You can see trends of this in sort of the cyborg thing of the transhumanism. They begin to think of themselves as these technologies. The same thing is happening, but in the specific topic of gender and sort of, I'm changing my body to become this thing. So again, we see that it's this placing in the future as a goal. And then that becomes sort of that vertical element that we see that is sort of stabilizing them, but we see that it's not really stabilizing anything because there's chaos everywhere right now in regard to these things. I'll hint at a certain topic and I'll take a couple questions because I know that was a lot, and then we'll go into, I think, that is what I believe is one form that this has been affecting the church as we grapple with sort of transhumanism and specific, in a particular form, sort of transgender ideology that has sort of certain movements within circles of the church that we'll begin to address. But first we'll pause there, take a couple questions for sort of clarity, because I want to have ground there before we get into addressing sort of ideas of the female diaconate and what that would mean and why I think that's a subset of sort of this trans ideology, a fluidity of gender identity, and what is human nature expressed as male and female. And as we go into the teaching of the church in regard to that. So we'll pause there for questions of what's going on. Peter.
Let me give you the microphone, Peter.
So isn't this just Genesis 11 again, with the Tower of Babel and the scattering?
In some sense. It is the attempt, in the sense that it is the attempt of placing a human ability to get to the divine, trying to at least. So on that level of sort of symbolism or a reenacting, yes, of the same sort of misplaced desire. Again, it's the sort of human self-referencing, but also thinking like we can get to the divine on our own. Either a personal thing, which I think is a lot of... some people are there, and other people just think of it as in this sort of general sense of like, there's this future humanity that's really what they're placing in sort of the God category. Yeah.
So maybe I really don't understand what you're saying, but as you were talking, I was thinking about where we're at right now. And it feels like, at least I feel like right now I'm struggling, you know, with this vaccine thing that's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel that there's the super people who are going forward with what is being offered, and then those that are not. You know, there's kind of a division going on in terms of thinking about it and what it truly means, because we are putting something in our body that is not normally what our body makes. Mm-hmm. It's a spiked protein. And there's a lot of questions around it, and what does it really mean? Mm-hmm. And I even had somebody say to me that possibly that, you know, something like this could be a way of tracking us or putting something in our body where they would be able to actually see.
The technology of getting to the sort of the specifics of that are not there yet. However, you know, there is this sense of that we need to be careful of on the spiritual plane of separating out of, you know, the parallel idea is like the enhanced versus the non-enhanced and who is more superior. There are ideas out there and sort of some in some circles, even in some powerful circles, saying that like if you're not, like you'll end up becoming some sort of second class citizen. So those are the things that we do need to be careful about. Their goals, as far as the transhumanists, are far greater than any sort of what the vaccine will be able to do or not. There are, however, you know, people who are trying to use the COVID like situation to enhance their power. And this is a story as old as time. People use others to disadvantage. And it is a line within transhumanist circles. And it's something that C.S. Lewis brings out. Someone has to create the new ideal. And that's never going to be a democratic process. It's always going to be some sort of power player. And so we do need to be sort of aware of that sort of thing. But we don't fight it in the same way that the world fights. But we can discern the teachings of the church and kind of find our way forward in the grace of God and hope that we're not deluded in the way we move forward. So there is a lot of discernment that needs to happen, especially in regards to things that we're being told we need to do that aren't necessarily natural. Yeah.
Father, I'd like to follow up to that question. I think somewhere currently or in the past, your counterpart in the Amish community is giving a talk about the dangers of electricity and television and gasoline and automobiles and so forth. Could you speak a bit to the difference between the warnings that you're outlining regarding technology and similar kinds of warnings of technology in the past, which we now take for granted as being wonderful contributions to human existence?
I think the fundamental difference is the speed of which it's happened and the speed of which we've forgotten how to live without it. The stark difference between living as an Amish person and even living as somebody in the 50s with a washer machine is far less than the Amish person who, you know, won't go beyond having a button in their shirt to the world we are now. And we as a people can't, it's not that we need to go back. It's not a problem of technology improving human life, but the difference is the fundamental difference that we would have between the Amish and what I'm presenting today as an Orthodox Christian in a way that we need to discern that is, what is the technology being used for? What are its goals? What is its, to use the philosophical term, telos? What will it end up being? The Amish are scared that it'll change their culture and their way of life in sort of in just on the communal level. What I'm speaking toward is a theological understanding of what it means to be any human being. The reference points in transhumanism are entirely in sort of an abstract future. They're not, and their goals are different and chaotic. As an Orthodox Christian, our goal is to be united with God. Their goal is to be somehow extend their own ego into eternity via some sort of AI integration. So the parallel is far more stark in the two. I would say they have a theology, though they won't call it that because they don't believe in God. They're essentially a bunch of atheists. But what they're doing instead is putting sort of this atheistic, atheological future human being in the place of God. That's nothing the Amish ever had to deal with. They were more just scared that it would change their cultural communal relations, that to be a closed off community. They began as a closed off community from the beginning, being Anabaptists. So their goals are far different. What we need to be aware of is, like, if I am going to use a technology, I think we do need to, one of the other fundamental differences is the sort of, is it part of my body or not? And is it helping me be a better human being, or is it trying to just simply make my life seamless and fix the problem of the fall without God? That's really the fundamental difference, is trying to fix the fallen human being via technology instead of a spiritual means. Not that that's a problem. I like not having to, like, go down to the river and wash my dishes. I like that I can track where I can go, but is it helping me become a better human being and draw closer to God, or is it simply just making my life and my egos and feeding everything in that. So I think that's the fundamental spiritual difference that we need to focus on.
Father, this is probably a topic for a whole seminar, but how do you love a transgender person? How does the church love a transgender person? Or anyone, I guess, who we see as going down a wrong path, or and that one's pretty profound because it does, as you say, often literally change their bodies. But I just, if you have any thoughts, I would love to hear them.
It's a difficult but simple response. Difficult in the sense that our own passions often get in the way of the Christian response. But the response is really rather simple. We are called to be martyrs and to not change our teaching to accommodate, right? The Orthodox Church has its theology of what it is to be a human being that was handed down to Christ, from Christ to us, and we uphold that. But that doesn't mean that we go like marching in the streets, or that when someone walks into our door who may have, you know, changed their bodies or is merely presenting themselves in the opposite gender, maybe they haven't gone as far as surgery, or, you know, one day, you know, this is, you know, probably, I mean, if that one author is right, like, in a mere 30 years, you know, cyborgs may be walking into churches. Like, so there is a sense that we'll have to deal with that as people come in, and where will healing be? But what it is that we present the teaching to them, and that we love them through presenting that teaching. And it's nothing in it is condemnation or judgment. How are they supposed to know when they were not part of us, right? Or even if they struggle with it, having been part of us, part of the church, and have received the teaching, but it's still a temptation. There are just ways that we can go about doing it, but it's sort of, you know, we can kind of leave it as an agree to disagree thing, but at the same time, if we aren't the ones cutting ourselves off from them, that's the part that makes us martyrs. That may lead to our very own martyrdom, but that's what Christ calls us to do, is to uphold the faith and, you know, let the world respond. And we may be called to be just like Christ and become his martyrs. But that's always in the act of love, and of showing the truth in that love. That we are not called toward whatever this trans ideologies are, that is something, but God calls us and has chosen us and provided for us and called us into being this way. And from in that way, that's our beginning point. And when we begin from there, that it has nothing to do with condemnation or judgment. It's merely upholding the truth and then moving on from there. And people will have time to get there, or it's up to them in complete freedom. And we should uphold our complete freedom to hold the church teaching. Father, then subdeacon.
I think what you said about the importance of this horizontal and vertical relationship, this idea how important it is that the church holds very firmly what it means to be in the image of God and to be transformed into his likeness. Mm-hmm. This is the central goal of life. And so it's like, here is, are the things that you're doing this? Mm-hmm. Are you being transformed in the likeness of Christ? Mm-hmm. I think that pillar, and thank God for the teachings we've been given and the church is holding firm to that. Mm-hmm. That pillar is just such an important piece. I think speak on that a little bit maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the main piece, and we've touched on it in many ways in answering the question about what's the difference between the Amish and what I'm talking about now, like, should we all have chips in our, like, is cyborg, what's the problem with being a cyborg, or what's, like, that sort of thing of being an enhanced human being, or why not upload our minds to the cloud or whatever, or integrate with it at least. The fundamental difference is that vertical thing, like, is that, whatever that is, how is that making us become more like Christ? That question is what needs to be answered for each technology as it emerges, or set of technologies as they emerge. Right now we're merely struggling with sort of our relationship with our smartphones, like, and yet we are going to like somehow figure out how we're gonna relate to the AI, our AI assistants. Even that, in sort of the technologies we have now, that should be a constant assessment of how is this helping me become the image of God and grow in my likeness to Him. But there's also, I would say, it's highly important to remember the horizontal plane. And when I mean the horizontal plane, I don't just mean all of the humans that are existing now. I mean all of the humans that have existed through all of time and that have handed down traditions to us, both little t traditions and big T tradition within the church. That sort of horizontal plane is also a stabilizing factor, because I would highly recommend everyone read Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis. There are other authors who have it, but he kind of has the most succinct Christian sort of presentation of what we could lose when we lose this idea of that we have a common human nature, and that it's not, that, and we, what we lose when we believe that human nature is just something we can make it to be, and that that mission will probably not be successful anyway. What it'll end up being is merely a power grab with many sort of oppressed people who can't take advantage of those technologies. And human nature will simply come in service of whatever their egoistic, selfish goals are. So I think both of those, you know, the horizontal and the vertical, it's the cross, which that we're called to be on as Christians. Okay, so what is that topic, the female diaconate, that I think is an extension of sort of gender confusion within the church? The female diaconate is something that has been advocated for within the church, and we have had women who have been called deaconesses, female deacons. So I want to present what that means, because they have existed in the church. They no longer, up until Alexandria laid hands on some women in West Africa to become deaconesses, but even they have certain roles. So what is this? What is the idea of the female diaconate? In the modern sort of idea, it's sort of it's the equivalent of a male deacon, right? Same liturgical role, same sort of thing. It's not gendered really, it's just a woman who wants to be a deacon. However, this isn't the idea that the church has. That from the beginning, in the first books of our scriptures, Deuteronomy 22:5 is a clue to us that God doesn't want the genders to be confused. A woman shall not wear anything that pertains to a man, nor shall a man put on a woman's garment. For whatever does the things is an abomination to the Lord. Remember, we kind of had a question about that in one of them. Abomination, we need to remember, is just something that's at variance with God's plan. Maybe a little more severely, but that's what it means. This word, kele, in the Hebrew, which is used for, pertains to a man and also for the woman's garment, is a word that means it's sort of a tool or a vessel. Here, it can be used to mean a garment. But the commandment, used by using this word, means that it's concerned with the gender role that the clothing signifies, not for the clothing itself as the main thing. So the clothing may change, but it's signifying being a man or being a woman. That's the important part, right? So what does it mean to be a man and what does it mean to be a woman? We talked about sort of gender roles in our sexuality topic. Male headship and female acceptance of authority, the helpmeet. Those are the gender roles that are being signified. So gender is reflected in this symbolism, as we talked about, of Christ being the man, the head, the provider, and the church being a woman in the female, like sort of female form, a body and a receiver, right? These are masculine and feminine roles, right? Within the church, I see that there's at least three ways that this is manifested. There's the commands for the female behavior in church that we see in scriptures, that we've kind of talked about through our sexuality talk. There's the marital commands to the Christian husbands and wives. And then there's the all-male clergy. Female and feminine roles more fully embody the feminine role of the whole church. So remember, the whole church is the bride of Christ. It's a bride, not a bridegroom. The bridegroom is Christ. So when we're speaking of the body of Christ, of the church, it's in feminine traits. And females, women, fully embody that role. So when we get to like 1 Corinthians 11, 5 through 12, the teaching on head coverings, it's a sign of submission to Christ and to being under his authority, right? So that the feminine role that Paul is asking women to do is part of that. It's more fully presenting and embodying the feminine role of the church in the feminine members of the church, in the female members of the church. And then in 1 Corinthians 14, 34 through 5, and then also in 1 Timothy 2, 11 through 15, there's the command to be women of women to be silent and not prophesy within church services. We kind of covered that. He's not talking about being out in the streets, that like they're prohibited from evangelizing or something like that. But rather there's this ordering of roles within the church, and female members are more fully embodying the more feminine role, right? So, and then to get to that second one, Christian marriage is a reflection of that relationship of the bride of Christ to the bridegroom, of the head to the body, right? It's a reflection of that ecclesial and divine reality of a human creaturely relationship to the uncreated God through the creatures of God. So there's this representing of roles within the church and then an embodiment of them within the church that Christian marriage has, and that the significant calls toward femininity within the church or female roles within the church manifest. And Christian marriage typifies the whole. So we have Ephesians 5 as the commands for husbands and wives in their marital roles. Remember, the husband is called to be like Christ in laying down his life and acting in that way. And the wives are called to be like the church, which is the body of Christ, to be the helpmeet to him. And then in Matthew 19:6, there's the permanency of marriage. He says, Christ's words, "Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let no man put asunder." So we have the eternity of the church also represented within a Christian marriage. And then we get to that third one, the all-male clergy, which we'll go into definitely this last topic. The all-male clergy, why do we have it? I think we can begin to answer that and then explore it. All of the church, as we've said, is feminine in that it receives and accepts the headship of Christ. That would include the clergy as members of the church, right? We're all, as someone becomes ordained, it's not like they stop being also a member of the church. They're still laity in one sense, but they're ordained for a particular role within the church to be and to manifest and represent and typify that for the rest of the congregation, that particular role. You can apply this to the whole ordering of the church, but particularly here in being a clergyman, a member of the priesthood. And so as the church is all feminine and it receives and accepts the headship of Christ, the priesthood is the particular reflection of the headship of Christ to present it to the whole church. So anytime there is a priest present, it's showing the headship of Christ to the rest of the congregation. Even he doesn't stop being also the bride of Christ, but in his role and in his reflection there. That is what the male clergy is doing. And especially in his role as serving as the one who offers the sacrifice and gives the blessing, right? So he does this by being the representative or the one who typifies Christ for the congregation. So why, what is it about femaleness that the church has said can't represent that? It's because the church never separates biological sex from gender, as we're shown in Deuteronomy. Gender traits or feminine masculine roles, sure, we can talk about those, right? We can talk about traits, like in my relationship to Christ, I'm the bride, he's the bridegroom. So putting myself in sort of a feminine trait or position, you could say. Who revealed himself as father and not simply as a parent, unisex, but particularly with a masculine designation. So a clergyman as being, and you can also see this in the quote from St. Ignatius of Antioch, when he talks about the clergy members of the church, the priesthood as a whole, deacons, priests, and bishops. Those are all members of the priesthood. He says in his epistle to the Magnesians, he tells all the faithful to honor the bishop as God, the deacon as Christ, and the presbyters as the apostles. All male titles. All masculine titles, if you will. So all of those people have male bodies, and in particular, they have their ways of reflecting the masculine perception of God to the congregation and by relation to the priesthood and to the priests. So the church, in relating to the priest, that eternal role of God as Father and Christ as coming as a man are both represented to the church in the male clergy. The laity have this particular role of representing the feminine role as receiving, but in relation to one another, those feminine and masculine roles of biological sex stand between one another. But in relationship to Christ, we can, sometimes we act as the receiver or the provider, depending on what role we are in relationship, marriage, within the church, so on and so forth. So in obedience to these things that Christ has given us, we hold to and that Christ appointed only male apostles. He had an abundance of opportunity to, count the women in his that were following him, including his own mother, as one of the apostles, and that were given this apostolic ordering of the church, the power to order the church and go and baptize the nations. They were all men. So in obedience to that, and in this understanding that our gender roles are a theomorphism, not an anthropomorphism. So God is not Father because men are somehow, not because men had power and that's why we read God as Father, but rather God is saying that men have this reflection of me and you have a relationship here. It comes from God down, not from man up. And we have this established within the church's borders. So maleness is able to, by the gender role given by God, to typify and make present at the altar the headship of Christ in a unique way that femaleness is not able to typify, since femininity is typifying the receptive role of the people of God, right? She has a particular role within the congregation of even better typifying that than a male can. Among the laity, if you will. So we have sort of this structuring down from the throne room of God to here, to the church. But like I said, deaconesses existed in the church. So what was that? What were the female deacons? Is there a wrinkle since they existed in this presentation that I've given to you? There's a thought among the Greek fathers that female deacons or deaconesses are an apostolic order, right? Well, maybe we see sometimes in the scriptures this word used that seems to imply that there were female deacons when you read it in Greek. And so they were unable to easily distinguish between an ordained deacon, which was very clear who the ordained, it's, you know, not all deacons were male deacons in the way that they were reading it. But this boils down to simply the word, using the word and its various cognates, diakonia. That is, a helper with a certain, diakonia means a helper, a person with a certain job within the retinue of the people who followed around the apostles on their missions. And this ambiguity led to the idea within the Greek-speaking church of female deacons. But the Latin-speaking church never had this problem. When they were given or translated the scriptures, they always had diakonia translated as the server or giving of a service, and deacon as an ordained order. So they never did. In fact, throughout the West's history, they would see this crop up periodically in the East, and only in certain churches in the East. And they would call councils, and they would condemn the practice of having a female diaconate. And they, whenever they heard that this was taking place in some sort of Eastern church, and it became sort of a bigger issue than just in one city. And they also condemned it as something that happened that was among the heretical groups of Christendom, so those outside of the Orthodox Church. They definitely existed there. But what were their roles? Even when they did exist, it's different than what is presented today as sort of the equivalent of a male deacon. There's the work, the didaskalia. It summarizes and regulates the duties and purposes of a female deacon in one part of its work. It does this for many things, but the part that's relevant here is doing it for the existence of female deacons. What were their role? It tells them what their role is. The other thing to keep in mind is that even the didaskalia is not actually a regulating thing. It's not wholeheartedly accepted book by the church. It's a regulatory writing that existed for a certain amount of time and that tells us kind of what the church in the East was grappling with. It's an Antiochian document. So what does it say when it comes to female deacons? It says, "Those that please thee out of all the people, thou shalt choose and appoint as deacons, a man for the performance of the most things that are required, but a woman for the ministry of women. For there are houses whither thou canst not send a deacon to the women, on account of the heathen, but mayest send a deaconess. Also because in many other matters the office of a woman deacon is required. In the first place, when women go down into the water, those who go down into the water ought to be anointed by a deaconess with oil of anointing. And where there is no woman at hand, and especially no deaconesses, he who baptizes must of necessity anoint her who is being baptized." So the first concern is that the male priest might be scandalized or scandalize other people by touching a woman to anoint her with oil. That's the concern there. There's even this line of, well, maybe you could use just another woman who's around to do this. It doesn't even have to be a deaconess. But to continue. "But where there is a woman, and especially a deaconess, it is not fitting that women should be seen by men. With the imposition of hand, do thou anoint the head only." So only touch her head instead of the rest of her body. "As of old, priests and kings were anointed in Israel, do thou in like manner, with the imposition of hand, anoint the head of those who receive baptism, whether of men or of women, and afterwards, whether thou thyself baptize or thou command the deacons or presbyters to baptize, let a woman deacon, as we have already said, anoint the women. But let a man pronounce over them the invocation of the divine names in the water," meaning they're the ones that actually, a priest is actually the one who baptizes the newly illumined. "And when she who is being baptized has come up from the water, let the deaconess receive her and teach and instruct her how the seal of baptism ought to be kept unbroken and in purity and holiness. For this cause, we say that the ministry of a woman deacon is especially needful and important. For our Lord and Savior also ministered unto by women ministers, Mary Magdalene, Mary the daughter of James, the mother of Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee, with other women besides. And thou also need the ministry of a deaconess for many other things. for a deaconess is required to go into the houses of the heathen, where there are believing women, and to visit those who are sick, and to minister to them in that which they have need, and to bathe those who have begun to recover from sickness. So we see here that there's a concern for scandal, and that's the purpose of female deacons. And it's only in a very particular element in the receiving and the anointing of the oil of gladness and of chrism, so that the male priests don't have to touch a woman. And the understanding here, some cultural context is that when you were received for those anointings, you were fully nude. So there's the scandal there that may happen. And so the church is attempting to order itself so that the scandal doesn't spread among the heathen. That's why the heathen keep getting mentioned, those who are non-Christians who don't understand and may read some sort of impropriety into the rites of receiving someone into the church. In a later document, which is called the Apostolic Constitutions, which is basically a summarizing of the Didascalia, and again, this work isn't one of our accepted books, but it tells us what the church was struggling with. It summarizes it, a deaconess's role this way. A deaconess does not bless nor perform anything belonging to the office of presbyters or deacons, but only is to keep the doors and to minister to the presbyters in the baptizing of women on account of decency. So we have a very limited role of female deacons. Saint Epiphanius of Salamis, in his Against Heresies, talks about this same role, and it's another witness to what a female deacon's role was. And he mentions the same things, but specifically talks about the reason. And he says, when a woman's body may be bared, so that she will not be seen by the male priest, but by the assisting female, who is appointed by the priest for the occasion, to take care of the woman who is in need of it when her body is uncovered. So he makes very explicit the reason for this existence of this office. And so the church, when it sees this and assumed, okay, so this must be an apostolic order, there must be a reason, it found a reason in order to keep decency as sort of its ordering principle. So here we don't see that there, even in Saint Epiphanius's quote, he doesn't even call it an order. He rather says that if there's a woman present, the priest should like appoint her to do this part, give her the blessing to do it. So there's not a firm indication that there is actually an order of deaconesses when it comes to Saint Epiphanius, but just a trusted woman of the parish that the priest can appoint. Canon 19 of the First Ecumenical Council, which would come along with this whole same era of the 3rd and 4th century, mentions deaconesses as part of the Paulinist heretical group. And when it's deciding what to do with the female deacons there, they decide to receive those female deacons as lay people and not as they did for others within this group, of receiving them again within their clerical rank. So we see that when they had a choice of someone who was probably functioning in a greater role than what is mentioned in the Didascalia, the Apostolic Constitutions, and Saint Epiphanius, they end up treating them not as part of this ordained order, as part of an apostolic order, you would say. I've mentioned this book before, but if you're interested in sort of this topic going in depth, it's a book that you can get in ebook form or in print called The Disappearing Deaconess, or Deaconesses, by Deacon Brian Patrick Mitchell. And he says that using the literary evidence alone, we can easily chart the trajectory of deaconesses in the regions where they were most common. From minor clergy, so meaning they were something like readers, cantors, but definitely they were usually below subdeacons, in the 4th century, to something like major clergy in the 6th century. They were given duties that major clergy meant they were given duties somehow in the altar, but not the same duties as a male deacon. And then back again to minor clergy, and then the lay office before the 12th century, and finally to a defunct office by order of the patriarch Athanasius I of Constantinople in the first decade of the 14th century. All of this only existed in the East. So even where it existed, this is sort of the trajectory that we can see. A finding of a use, a very particular sort of use for females, deaconesses given that title, and you know, a laying on of hands, much like a reader or a cantor would be, and then sort of a morphing of roles, and then it just completely has not been part of the church's life from the 14th century on, in any form, anywhere in the church. So, what's the conclusion? The role of the deaconess as a specific role would be to assist in situations where a woman would be naked, or scandal would arise in the case of going into a home where they're needing to be taken care of. This was done to preserve the priests and male deacons from the scandalous accusations or the hint of temptation in touching the woman to chrismate her or anoint her with the oil of gladness, or other limited and delegated roles for a deaconess when it would appear scandalous for a priest to visit. However, if none were available, the church demanded these visitations and chrismations still take place by the hand of the priest. So despite scandal, it was more important to take care of the sheep. This modern idea of the restoration of a female diaconate has little or no resemblance to what a deaconess was in church history. Nowhere did they serve the same role as male deacons, and in the vast majority of orthodoxy in the West and in the East, so in place and in time, only in certain cities and in certain parts of the East did they ever exist. Female deacons did not exist for the vast majority of the church. So it's not, in the end, when we look and carefully read through this, there was never really an apostolic order of female deacons. Rather, we had more people doing a service. It was far more like what we find in Scripture when it was ambiguous of what is this an ordained order or not, or are they doing a service? When we get into the weeds of what that actually meant, it was more like the women were given a role to help the priest do their job when it may have been scandalous. And this was their role throughout church history, and this is eventually why the order and the title eventually just disappears for many other reasons that you can get into by reading that book. But so this whole idea of gender order and this sort of, well, we're equal, so what's the point there? This gender order is very important in our response toward specifically the subset of transhumanism that is called transgenderism, in our application to that. But we also, need to keep it in mind for our own salvation and in obedience to Christ for what he's given us. So there we have sort of the overview, and I think sort of an issue in the church where it has touched and affected us in a unique way that I think we can address as I've addressed it, and begin to give an answer that we can grow into and in a better understanding of what it means to be male and female followers of Christ, men and women who follow Christ. We don't follow him simply as gender-neutral people or sort of gender-confused people, but within our God-ordained bodies and what that means. So that's the presentation for this, and we'll open back up for questions. Huria.
So you've talked a lot about the male role within the church, and I was wondering, can you speak to the feminine role that you've alluded to and how it relates to the Theotokos and being the body of Christ?
Sure. The feminine role is the one that typifies mostly the church's call to be the one who receives the word of Christ. So everything about sort of the way that the church has regulated the feminine role to typify that in the commands that we've mentioned, or the for head coverings, keeping silent, not being the one who teaches in church. That's what prophecy really kind of meant, the one who is teaching the rest. That role is typified through those things, through those scriptural ways of expressing femininity. And in that, it's what they, when I say typify, it means that that's the model that the rest of the church really should follow in its relationship down through the that hierarchy of extending from the throne room of God down to the church that's represented in gender in this topic, at least. So are men who are in the church, whether they're priests or not, in the relationship to Christ, can learn from the women in that way that they are taught, that is taught to be within the church and to model that piety and that call of spirituality of silent and obedience and sort of being receptive to that, to be able to listen, then called to help, right? The helpmeet role is called for all of us in relation to Christ, where we are in some sense the helpmeets of Christ to go out into the world and act on his behalf, which is the same thing a wife is called for with her husband. There's sort of this regulation and role. Yes, there's sort of a back and forth, but in the end, there's the order of husband and wife, and one's called to be the helpmeet and the other to be the provider and lay down his life for her. So what a feminine role within the church is more is the greater embodiment of the ones who are the brides of Christ. And the ultimate ones would be sort of the nuns, right, who are called to the sort of the greatest silence, and the monastics in some sense are also married to Christ, male monastics meaning. So we have these various roles of typifying and learning from one another within our roles and relations to one another. As we're relating to one another, we learn how to relate to kind of greater up the hierarchy of relationship to God, right?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Even though I'm the mic deliverer, this isn't necessarily my argument, but just an argument one might make. You in the text that describes the function of the diaconess mm-hmm. that you described, it refers to the reason they're doing this is so that the heathen isn't scandalized by a bad view of the church, right? Mm-hmm. And heathen could also be called the secular, mm-hmm. like the secular world.
Sure.
So couldn't one make the argument that our current secular environment would not want to be scandalized by the fact that we don't have a diaconess? Wouldn't that shield us from some of the scandal of the secular if we had women in those leadership roles?
I see what you mean, yeah. I think the concerns there would be different. The church has never given up its call to the reason that the church was kind of made, defended or sort of acquiesced to saying, okay, so this must be an apostolic order for this purpose, female diaconate as an apostolic order for this purpose, was because the church has always been concerned with its, what you can call like its moral image, but like actual morals, not just like, I disagree ideologically with this. Morals in the sense of like, well, the priest will be accused of committing adultery or, you know, molestation or these sorts of things. The church is highly sensitive for those sorts of call because it's our call to holiness, to represent and be the holiness of Christ in the world. When it comes to ideas and critiques of the church within how the church represents our relationship to God, the church has always been stalwart in accepting whatever consequences the world decides to heap upon our head in those sorts of things. This is what the martyrs did. Like, it was a scandal to the pagans that we didn't, like, you know, put a pinch of incense onto their gods, but nonetheless, the church was like, well, they're foreign gods that are demons, and so we're not doing that. And so, therefore, we have martyrs. In some sense, there's a relationship closer to that in sort of the scandal of that the church is not egalitarian, that we have not embraced egalitarianism as part of the gospel. That's not part of the gospel. And so in the order of creation that God has established, we are called to remain stalwart in that. And that's that it relates in that way to that sort of question. That would be my response to that, is that it has not to do with just scandal, carte blanche, but scandal with over what? And that is that the message of the gospel that we want to give? Part of the message of the gospel is that we have a relationship to Christ and we're called to a certain relationship with Christ and who he created us to be. And that we defend.
A couple of comments. One, Father Alexander Schmemann spoke about this gender difference. And he talked about the male being kind of representing the institution, mm-hmm. kind of taking the role of kind of establishing the altar, mm-hmm. and the woman represented the eschaton, this ability to receive Christ and open the gates of paradise. Mm-hmm. So both roles occur in the church, that you have this male form that's establishing the institution, tending the altar, mm-hmm. but the female is opening the gates of paradise. I just think it's the mother of God, you know, opened us the doors of thy compassion, mm-hmm. O blessed Theotokos.
Yeah.
So we have this real beautiful sense of this necessity of both male and female working liturgically, mm-hmm. institution, eschaton. Mm-hmm. Very powerful image, I thought. The other is, this was a teaching of Father Richard, and helped it be very clear. One was that authority is inherent in nature. Mm-hmm. So male and female have equal authority. They just have different roles. And that is, because today somehow we have this idea that role equals authority. No, authority is equal. But roles are different. And so we have the same authority. In other words, to the authority to accomplish what God desires me as a human being to accomplish, the authority mm-hmm. to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's equal in male and female. Roles are different. So I think we get confused sometimes. You may speak because that's role and authority get flipped. And we get confused about, well, that means you have more authority than me. No, I just have a different role than you have.
I would speak to it in the sense that in our human nature, we have the same authority to the created world as the same as everybody else. Like, we're all called to be priests. I just have an Orthodox priest just has a particular role to represent that authority to the rest of the people. So the role and authority in relation to each other, it's a good distinction. And the expression of the authority happens within our roles. And we're called to sort of certain ways of expressing that in our uniqueness as a human person, but part of the defense of that uniqueness of the human person is the bodies that God created us to be in. So it can get very confused when we start to mix match those sorts of terminologies in when we're talking with the world. And words sort of change in their usage over time. So if we're clear and kind of keep solid to that, Those are good things, yeah. We are at 6 o'clock, so we'll go straight into Vespers.